This is a continuation of the oral history interview with Emeritus Professor Stanley Cutler, October 17th, 2006. Stan, when we left off yesterday, you were explaining why you had not aspired to administrative leadership of the department, and I'm interested in any observations that you have about the department and the leadership of it.
Well, first, let me reiterate my own view, my own position. Yes, once in a while I thought of it, but I think in the cold light of sober thought, I always rejected it because I was too busily wrapped up in other things. I set out early in life to become a professor. I thought of myself essentially as a teacher. I discovered writing. I thought of myself very much as a historian. I was very, very busily engaged in that. I created a journal, which today still survives. I did it for 25 years. It's an extremely important journal to the field. It's a review journal, and it's had a great deal of popularity. I feel very good about that, but I was devoted to that, too. So, take a little interest in being chairman. Now, as a corollary to that, let me remark that I think there were a lot of other people who felt the same way. And the department had a difficult time, particularly in the 1990s, recruiting or gaining good people to be chair, of the department. The truth was there was some inherent tensions over the nature of what a department should be. That resulted in divisions, maybe even polarization. It seems there is some sort of axiomatic rule that weakness begets weakness. Here I gave you what I think is my analysis of the state of the department at the time, and then because of that, or in spite of that, we clearly, to my mind in retrospect, chose badly for leadership, and we were not well served. I don't think these were evil people or dumb people or any such thing. I don't think that they were people who should have been chairman. They were people with too much of an agenda of their own. And instead of use a current political phrase, instead of uniting, they divided further. And it hurt for a while because of that. The curious thing is, I would argue, though, that that period was a very rich period for the department in recruiting new blood. There were some excellent appointments made. Almost, again, in spite of or despite the prevailing condition. I think on the whole, they were good appointments. Mm-hmm. And so you know, there's strength and weakness wherever you go, in whatever you look at. But it is my understanding that as we speak now in 2006, that for the past 3 years, the leadership of the department has been absolutely outstanding, and that I think is owing to the indefatigable energies and intelligence of Steve Stern, and now there's David McDonald, another brilliant man with inexhaustible energy and the willingness to serve. And I think that with I thought that with in Steve's hands, and I think I'm quite confident in David's hands, the departmental mood, feeling, situation, whatever it is very definitely for the better. So I'm very optimistic about that.
And so you're pleased with the current status of
absolutely.
The history department?
Absolutely. I feel that David is just starting. Steve did wonderful things. For example, as never before, he engaged the department chairman in this new phenomenon of fundraising. Mm-hmm. I helped him on a couple of occasions with a couple of prominent alumni who have given very, very handsomely. I'm very, very happy that I could still continue to serve the department in that way. The monies that have been made available by Peter Weil, for example, and by Harold Kaplan, who were both prize students of mine, I think came about, first of all, because of their own desire, but I know I helped them devise programs that they could, for which they could contribute. Steve did a masterful job on that. Steve did a masterful job, but when he took over, the department was really in the midst of some fantastic turnover by retirements. And he reached out to the retired faculty, and he started a series of inviting us back to speak to really a general departmental-wide audience on what are we doing, and are we still alive? And Steve asked me very, very specifically to speak about my attempts, feeble as they are, to be a playwright now. And it was a wonderful thing, and others have done this, and I must say it's very, very gratifying.
Mm-hmm. Great. Stan, let me move on now to ask you for your reflections about significant students, graduate as well as undergraduate, that you worked with in the course of your career.
Well, that's what we're here for, to teach. And I've been blessed. I've just had wonderful graduate students. Wonderful students, graduate and undergraduate. When I first came, I think I told you before, I got a graduate seminar all my own.
Mm-hmm.
And my first year, I just had some fantastic people who had gone on to rich careers. I had a guy, for example, named Bill Weissick, who came here. Bill is only a year and a half younger than myself, but he comes from an adjoining neighborhood in Cleveland where I grew up. Although there was a vast gulf. In that. But Bill came here with a Harvard Law degree and just didn't like practicing law anymore.
Hmm.
He wanted to become a professor, and he worked with me. And Bill has gone on to done distinguished work, very, very distinguished. Pleased to say that when I retired, he was invited back to give a talk representing all my students. There were some others I would have to mention. Michael Belknap, whose dissertation became a first-rate book on the subject of the government political trials of communists, which remains a standard to this day. John Tiford, who's done pioneering work in urban legal history. Another good one that comes to mind. I've had others, but that early group was really just fantastic. I met a number of good people. I think I said at one time, though, after about 15 years here, what shall I say? Turned off a little bit by graduate education? Yeah, I think so, because the quality of graduate students declined beginning in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. They declined quite simply because the profession had little marketability. There were better places to be than to be a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we would get a very good graduate student the first year, we found that we couldn't keep him. We couldn't keep him with fellowships and everything. We lost him to another place. And that's why the university had to change its whole policy and adopt package deals to lure good graduate students here. Well, I saw that, and look, I'll be absolutely blunt about it. There are few joys greater than a good graduate student. There are few burdens more onerous than weak or mediocre graduate students. The good graduate student is highly motivated, self-propelled, and is a pleasure to behold. The graduate student whose work you have to rewrite, and show them how to write, how you try to teach them to be analytical with little or no success, that's draining. So I don't mean to be snobbish or elitist about this. I'm just telling you how I felt. But I had an alternative. The alternative always was undergraduate education. And I believe I briefly alluded to the fact before that I had a great deal to do with establishing the department-wide undergraduate colloquia, which became a requirement. But I had fun inventing courses on that under that, which I discussed. And but in my lecture course, for example, you know, a course like entitled American Legal and Constitutional History is not a course like the American Civil War. The American Civil War, after all, the Civil War is America's great soap opera. It's our family drama. And, you know, you teach a course that the carriage trade comes in, as my Civil War colleague Dick Sewell likes to say. But a course such as mine, I think students are, your classes are a little more self-selected. They're there because they want to be there. They think that there's a real purpose to it. Now, through the years, I had to put up with undergraduates who honestly believed that taking my course was crucial to getting into law school. That, as we used to say in Madison, in 10 cents, would buy you a cup of coffee at Rutabaum's. But, I mean, it was silly. But they believed this. I remember once I had a student who was hysterical because he was only getting an A-B in the course. And I can tell him, I said, you know, this will change your whole GPA by a sliver. Because he said he needed that grade to get into law school. And I said, why do you think this is so important? He said, well, because it's your course. And they'll value, they'll look particularly for that. I said, you flatter me, but it's not true. The law school is too busy with applications to see whether or not you had a course with Stanley Cutler. Believe me. And And finally, I said to him, I said, tell me, what did you get on the LSAT score? And he got kind of shamefaced, and he said, he told me, it was in the low 60 percentile. So I said, do me a favor. Go get your grade change on your LSAT. That'll help you a lot more that way. But I used to get these kinds of students. In fact, almost to my despair, I remember years ago I had a steady stream of pre-med students because a colleague's son, pre-med students, you understand, in their senior year really have it all done. And, you know, they can now they can get themselves educated and they can enjoy college. They take all kinds of courses. Well, this son of a good friend decided to take my course. And for about 3 years, he started a tradition of my having pre-med students. They were terrific. Unfortunately, I went on leave once, and then, you know, you're out of sight, out of mind. I had the same thing happen with nurses. I loved it. It was a delight to have it. Because, you know, it got to a point in the later years, I used to say, how many of you plan to go to law school? 95% of them raise their hands. I'd look at them and I'd say, why? I said, you considered alternatives, you know. No, they just didn't know what they wanted to do, and so forth. Well, anyhow, though, but I had a lot of great, great students. And it would be tough to single out names. There are a few names. I mentioned a couple of them before that I've helped with fundraising. Most notably Harold Kaplan, who is now one of the very leading bankruptcy lawyers in the nation. He's in Chicago. He's managing partner of a very big firm. He was an undergraduate with me. He later went to the University of Chicago Law School. While he was in law school, he was coming up and finishing a master's with me. Mm. And he talked about a dissertation. Ironically, he wanted to do a legal social history bankruptcy, and he landed in bankruptcy law later on, quite by accident. But he was great. Peter Weil, who's a very notable contributor to the financial well-being of this university, he and his wife were both by students, ex-wife, were both by students. This is in the early 70s. And they just, Peter was fantastic. He still calls me, I say, about once every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Harold, I see in Chicago. Another one I see in Chicago is another lawyer with the Labor Department. A woman named Susan, well, her name was Bissiger. Her name is now Witz, W-I-T-Z. Oh, Susan's terrific. She had a girl who came, the other two students, these were sophisticated big city boys. Susan was a girl who came out of Monroe, Wisconsin. I used to tell her to bring me back Limburger cheese, you know. In those days, students used to bring me salamis from New York, you know. You could do that kind of thing then. She came to Madison, and Madison just changed her life. She always says that being in my course changed her life. She's a fantastic student, very loyal, and I'm grateful to have known her and to have had her in my class, the same with Harold and Peter. And there are others, I just can't, you know, fish them out now, but...
Were these three all history majors?
I think so. Oh, another great one. young man by the name of Henry Beta. Henry Beta was the genius son of Hans Bethe, our genius Nobel laureate who worked with Oppenheimer at Los Alamos during World War II. Henry was a real favorite of mine, and I knew his father, who recently died at the age of 98, an incredible human being. And one time, Hans used to come here every year to give a lecture when Henry was in school. I think he did it out of gratitude to his friends in the physics department for them getting Henry into the university. I said he was a genius son of genius parents. Henry just didn't take school seriously for a long while. He did when he came here, though. But as he was finishing, he announced he wanted to be a professional bridge player. And his mother carried, she pleaded with me, "I've got to stop, Henry. What can I do?" And so I said, "There's nothing I can do. He wants to be a professional bridge player. He will be." And sure enough, he did. He was on the number 2 U.S. team for about 5 years, and then he wound up as a vice president of Chase Manhattan National Bank. So, but Henry, I'm in touch with. He was great. He was just, he was in a whole other dimension. So I just had so many like that.
Stan, let me ask you, in all the years that you taught, did you see an evolution in terms of the quality of the students? Better, worse, stayed the same?
I think students have changed. Just thought of a couple more. When I came here in the 60s, and well into the 70s, and the early 80s,
This concludes side one of tape 3. This is side 2 of tape 3, Stanley Cutler.
Yes, I think students have changed. And I go on what older students have told me themselves. They tell me that when they were here in the 60s and the 70s, that the most important thing in their lives were their classes and their professors. That's why they were here. This one woman, she's from Milwaukee, she was terrific. Barbara Goldberg was her name. Well, Barbara Balkansky was her name. I had her sister, and I had her three sons. And she was in my first class. And Barbara told me, you know, that they used to go back to the dorm at night. And they would talk about, what did Mossy say today? Or what Stanley Cutler said? Or what Harvey Goldberg said? These were the important things in their lives. That's why they were here. I think today, going to school is one of many busy things in people's busy lives. I always sarcastically say, well, you know, it comes in there somewhere between watching MTV and talking on the cell phone. Students have a lot of other, quote, interests, unquote, quote, activities, unquote. I understand today attendance is quite poor. That wasn't true. People didn't want to miss a class. People were afraid of using somebody else's notes. It wasn't good enough. I think in that sense, I can't say what students are dumber. They're not dumber. They're not brighter. Years ago, when we began to get the tremendous pressure on law school admissions, when somebody figured out at one point that by the present standards of GPA, law school, law boards, etc., that probably 3/4 of the lawyers practicing in Wisconsin couldn't get in today. And I asked some older colleagues about this, Willard Hurst being one. I said, you think the students are better now than ever were? He said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. He said, I said, do you think they'll make better lawyers? He said, absolutely not. He said, they may not. He said, there have been good people, there have been bad people. That's all. But I just think that the commitment, by the commitment, I guess I'm saying, pretty much once the totality of their commitment to their education 30 years ago was a lot different than it is today. That's all. I believe that. But, you know, I know there's a certain amount of old fogyism and things were better in my day kind of remark to that. I don't mean it to be such. As I say, there are bright students out there and so forth.
Are you glad you're not teaching these days?
Well, I had my time. That was it. It would be difficult today looking out students using computers to take notes when I know damn well they're playing solitaire. It's not that I'm glad I retired, it's just that I did it and that's it, you know, and like it or not, I'm mortal. that's all.
Stan, let me ask you now, I think it's quite interesting that you got an appointment to the law school. Would you talk about how that came about? And when that happened, and what it meant?
When it come about, I think probably after I was here about 15 years. And the only thing was that, you know, it just never had come up, but there was no problem with it. I was a full member of the law school. Some of my courses that I would teach on the graduate level were designed for law students or that take with the conjunction with history graduate students. Mm-hmm. The law school was for many years, when it was a very good place, it was very much my intellectual and to some extent my social home. And I described before my incredible relationship with Willard Hurst. The fact is there were other people there that I thought very, very highly of, and it proved very helpful to me. And so, you know, it was just I think what happened, I remember one year, there were a couple of us who were in the other part of the university. Joel Grossman in political science. One other person who, you know, were legal scholars in one way or another, as I was a legal scholar. So he said, well, you know, you really ought to be a member of the faculty. And so that's all that happened. That's all that happened. A couple of times I got a little extra research funds out of it and so forth. But it was,
does that still happen these days? That
I think there are a number of joint appointments. I don't know anybody else in the history department. Oh yeah, there's one person in the history department who has a joint appointment with the law school now.
Stan, I also want to ask you about Harvey Goldberg Center for Study of Contemporary History. And that was a controversial.
I don't think it was controversial. It's just I have some, not so much regrets. I just wish I could have done more. Well, after Harvey died.
Which was in the 80s?
No. 87. I know the conjunction of dates. Harvey left some money. A lot of people were surprised at this. So we discovered that Harvey Goldberg was a reader of the Wall Street Journal. They must have been fools, because as Harvey said to me once, you got to understand what the enemy is doing. So, he was a single man. He made investments to cover his old age and so forth, and he did. And then there was money left over. Well, Maury Meisner, my colleague, who was very close to Harvey also, in fact, his wife, she's a saint, she was nursing Harvey through his final illnesses. And Harvey had this tremendous interest in contemporary history. We used to teach a course called Contemporary Societies. And we decided to try to create an institute. To do that. And we had some money, we raised a little money, and for the first couple of years we brought in visitors to team teach a course in contemporary society and so forth. Well, while I understand it is still alive and doing fairly well, I don't know how well they've done in fundraising, and that was where we became a cropper. Both Maury Meisner and myself were busy. I mean, we were still writing, we were active, and I did not tell you, fundraising is a full-time enterprise. And we really never could get our bearings with it. Controversial? Oh yeah, there were some people at the university who thought this was some sort of radical endeavor and crawled out of the woodwork. But I must say, Donna Shalala, on the advice of Fred Harvey Harrington, who was an important advisor to us, Donna Shalala quickly approved it, and there was no problem whatsoever. Let's just say, I think the thing had enormous potential. It had enormous potential for two things. It had enormous potential as a kind of institute that could have a certain vibrancy and resonance around here. There were all kinds of people, history, political science, sociology, economics, psychology, and so forth, who were interested in problems of contemporary society. And this institute could have been the proper medium for bringing together the spirit people. Like we had once created, I was frankly using the model we created with Law and Society. Yet I don't think that we successfully reached out at that time. And then also the other great failure was in fundraising. I mean, I thought we had a splendid opportunity there. Harvey was enormously popular. The little bit we did, one day I get a letter from a guy I knew at Ohio State. He said, "Yo, you remember me?" And I vaguely did. He said, "I hear you got this thing going in behalf of Harvey." He said, "I'm a doctor now. I never forgot Harvey's lessons." And he says, "I always feel a little guilty about things, and I would like to make a contribution." Well, he gave us something like $2,500. But you know that in fundraising, the trick is that after a person gives you $2,500, within 3 months you're back at them and say, "Oh, it's time to renew." Or, that's what I mean. It's a, and neither Maury nor I had the time or the ability. I must be honest about that. And we were indecisive about hiring people to do this for us. It just, let's say, it did not succeed for want of energy. But I understand it's going now. I don't know. I don't talk. Nobody asked me about it, you know. Nobody asked Maury about it in terms of what we're trying to do and so forth. And I saw one thing that they put on, and I thought, well, it's not something we would have done, but everybody to his own. So, but I hope it's a fitting memorial for Harvey. After we started this, Ohio State, where he taught, finally decided to use Leonard Harvey's name to get money on behalf of undergraduate teaching. And they called on, well, Harvey taught there 10 years. Mm. And Harvey had a rich supply of students there who have given very nicely to a fund. They have it as a regular departmental fund. Mm. And I remember one time I wrote to them and I said, you know, I said, how about providing us with a list of names and so forth? And, then I wrote him again. And he said, "Oh, by the way, we've created our own fund," you know. So that was the end of that.
So there's not a chair here in history in Harvey's name?
Maury Meisner had a chair he named after Harvey. I don't know that anybody else does, though. I don't know.
Stan, I would like to switch the interview now to focus on work which is so significant and of great interest to many people, which is your work on President Nixon and the entire Watergate tragedy and the significance of that in American history. And you certainly are the preeminent historian of that era. If you would talk about how you got into that and what the entire story was.
Thank you. I always say, I had a life before Richard Nixon. and unfortunately, there are too many young people who think that's all I've done. Well, anyhow, they're worse fates. Watergate, you know, occurs 72, 74. At the time, it made a profound impression upon me because, of course, it involved impeachment, which is a constitutional topic. I taught it all the time, and I was just fascinated by Watergate, watched the hearings repeatedly, so forth. About 1985, I had finished another book, my book on political trials. I thought to myself, you know, there's got to be a lot of good, rich documentation of Watergate. And the Nixon papers, which supposedly were being done, might be ready soon. So I made an inquiry and I was told, yes, they're going to be ready soon. So about late 85, I decided I want to write the first serious history of Watergate. In other words, as one of my reviewers said, to take it beyond journalism. to try to deal with it as a historical problem and fit it into the larger context of American history. Well, I did that. I talked about English medieval history and impeachment, to give you some resources of impeachment. But I talked about this really like it. I never wrote such a big book before, because I think it's too big. But anyhow, I started that in late 85. And I think I told you before, David Ward, later our chancellor with distinction, then associate dean of the graduate school, really in charge of research money, I went to him for some out-of-season help. And David asked me to just write him a proposal. And to make the long story short, David granted me a few thousand dollars to make some trips back and forth to Washington and a Xerox on material, which I did. And then finding out a scheduled date of Nixon papers, everything, I determined to go ahead with this in 86, early 87. And indeed, the first Nixon papers came out in April 87, and pursuant to the law, the first thing they had to do was stuff related to Watergate, and all the wonderful materials of Nixon's top aides were made available, and his top aides were compulsive note takers who would meet with the president for an hour and a half, and discuss Watergate ad nauseum. And so, I gained all kinds of insights into this, and I did a lot of interviewing. I interviewed some very famous people.
Like who?
Old Richard Helms, the head of the CIA. Spiro Agnew, who had been vice president of the United States. I'm the only person who ever got to interview him.
How'd you do that?
He, by that time, hated Nixon. And he wanted to talk. But it was interesting. Then I talked to John Dean and others. All that stuff's in the State Historical Society now. I understand it's being used by people who come through and look at my transcripts of my interviews and everything. Anyhow, I started to write this book. It was published in 91. Had a very good critical reaction. I had a lovely book tours during a lot of prominent programs. And also, of course, this gave me a place for the future as I made many a Rolodex file as, quote, an expert on Nixon or whatever, so forth. So, through the years, I've been on a lot of shows because of that. So,
Stan, what did you learn writing that book that was new to you?
Well, there were a lot of things, I think, that were new. But first of all, Watergate had been written about as in terms of a political problem, a personal problem for Nixon and so on. I kept trying to see things in a much larger stream of the context of American law, of American constitutionalism, so forth, as well as absolutely the personality of Richard Nixon. And I think I came to know him quite well as a result of that. Learn things. We know that Nixon constantly flaunted, or ignored the advice of his legal counsel. Mm-hmm. I know, his top lawyer, his former law partner, one of the most brilliant lawyers in the United States, whom he named his counselor, couldn't even get in to see the president without going through Alexander Haig. And I once said to this man, I said, "You're a very smart man." And he smiled at me and said, "Smarter now than I was then." And I said, "And you're a very good lawyer." I appealed very, very much to his vanity. And he said, "Yeah." I said, Well, you tell me, if you're so smart and you're such a good lawyer, how do you have a client you can't even get in to see? I looked at you very seriously. The number of things I really learned in an interview were very, very small, but this was a precious moment. I said, you don't understand. He said, Nixon didn't see us as his lawyers. Nixon saw us as mere staff men. And it's a difference. In fact, I got to know Bill Clinton's lawyer quite well. I got to know him well because he told me he had read my book thoroughly in preparation for dealing with Nixon, with Clinton. And I told him this story, and I just related, but I said, did you have any trouble getting in to see Nixon, Clinton? And he said, absolutely not. So, Nixon was, sorry, he screwed up here. Clinton was a good enough lawyer to know to follow his lawyer's advice. But anyhow, I learned things like that. Remember the deal about the CIA and this. Where this story goes is the book, in and of itself, I regard as successful, and I enjoy doing it. And as much as I might have groused about having of doing Richard Nixon, as one of my children said to me, "It's a good living, Dad. Don't knock it." And so, indeed, it was.
How many copies of the book sold?
I think about 70,000.
Wow.
70, something like that. I said, but I knew there was something that still bothered me. And that was that despite the fact that there was a law on this matter, we did not yet have the tapes. Now, in April of 87, when the first papers were released, I said to the archivist in charge, I said, and what about the tapes? He said, oh, they're almost all ready. They'll be out in a few months. Unfortunately, a few months turned to a few years. What was happening? The man who had been head of presidential libraries, very good man, a good archivist, died. He was succeeded by a man who, among other things, made it clear that he thought it was his duty to protect the president. Among his other duties, he thought it was necessary for him to lie, as we subsequently found out. And I kept requesting this. And finally, in 1992, this new head of presidential libraries said to me, well, we're going to release the cabinet tapes. I said, the cabinet tapes? Those are meaningless. Nothing ever happens at a cabinet meeting. I later found out that because tourists would go past the cabinet room and their comments would trip the tape machines, and there would be tourist comments. It was nothing. It was merely a delaying device. And then he said to me, said all the Watergate tapes had been out. Now, the Watergate tapes that were out were the ones that came out during the time of the affair in 73, 74. Mm-hmm. That amounted to about 33, 34 hours of tapes. We knew the total number of tapes were 4,000 hours. He told me that all the Watergate tapes were out. I had been approached by a prominent law firm about challenging him. And I went to them and I said, he's lied. They said, how do you know? I said, I can prove that there are more than 33 hours, that there are hundreds of hours of tapes related to Watergate and the archives. Go ahead. Well, I gave them the proof. We filed suit. What was the proof? The proof was I just worked like a good historian. The proof was that in all these Watergate papers of his chief aides, particularly his two most prominent ones, H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, Dixon would ring a buzzer for them all day long, and they'd come in and they'd sit there with legal pads taking extensive notes. They were beautiful note takers. They wrote down everything. And day after day, I mean, they were as complicit in Watergate as Nixon was. Day after day, Nixon is going on ranting and raving about Watergate, and they're taking off down. Now, hundreds of hours. And when, in fact, when I was deposed, the government lawyer could not believe that I knew this. She only believed that somebody had, quote, leaked information to me. You know, Washington, they believe the only way you learn something is through a leak.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had to explain this to her. She was so dumb, she couldn't understand me. Anyhow, we made an intention to file suit. We did. We filed suit against the Archivist of the United States. Within 2 days, Richard M. Nixon joined the suit as intervenor. So there I am, Stanley Cutler versus National Archives and Richard Nixon. Hey, immortalized in a title of a case. Well, we proceeded, and I could say this right now, 14 years after filing suit, I have not a shred of doubt in my mind that if Richard Nixon were alive at this moment, we'd still be fighting, because he was determined never to let those tapes go.
Really?
He knew what was in those tapes. He knew. He always would say, wow, the tapes are going to exonerate me. To which I would reply, if they're going to exonerate him, then let's have them. Oh, no, no, no. National security. Can't let, you know, and everything. He just wasn't going to let it go. Well, there was a God, and in 1994, Nixon died. And when he died, he provided in his will that any future money he received from the government as compensation for their taking his papers, he had a suit going on that, had nothing to do with me. He said, that money's got to go to the preservation of my library. So my lawyer then questioned the executors and the other lawyers, saying, the Nixon estate is pretty well diminished, because Nixon wrote book after book primarily to feed his lawyer habit, and he had just was running out of money. And they said, if you want to gain money, you don't want to pay lawyers anymore. So we urge you to settle this. We offered them a chance to have mediation, which we did, and which I won everything. The mediation settlement in 1996 was a complete victory. Calling for the complete release of the tapes, and in fact, I insisted on a provision that the tapes could be played publicly. They couldn't before that.
Oh.
And now you can. Now they've all been released except for the last segment of 900 hours, and I know the archives is dragging its feet on this. It's catch-22. They don't have enough resources, but they haven't got it done. It'll get done. I'm not fighting that anymore. But I've had tremendous satisfaction from this, because nobody works this subject without using those tapes. We're on the verge of a new book coming out by my good friend Bob Dalek. That's on Nixon and Kissinger. He's used all their tape recordings, which came as a result of my suit. And when that book appears, Henry Kissinger will rue the day he was born, because those tapes damn him every which way. And sometimes they're misused. They're not used in a proper way, but... I feel very rewarded on that. It was a big victory for me.
This concludes side two of tape three. This is tape number four, side one of the ongoing oral history interview with Emeritus Professor Stanley Cutler. You were just talking about the use of the tapes in the new book on Kissinger.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So, when will that book on Kissinger and Nixon be out?
Oh, that book will be out this spring. But it's more than just that book. I mean, I've probably been in touch with about 20 people who are doing this, and it's just enormous. And, you know, I must say, it is very gratifying. It's very fulfilling to hear this from these people who are very grateful and who are doing good history, interesting history, etc. And besides, the case has given me a nice lecture topic through the years. If I just did it again last week at my 50th class reunion.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a rewarding thing. I just been very happy.
Stanley, what can you tell us about Richard Nixon? What did you learn about him from all the tapes that you've listened to?
Well, I learned a lot of things. I suppose that's why I've decided that the only way left for me to deal with Richard Nixon is through another medium, and that is through a play. Man, Richard Nixon's a piece of work. How did we ever get such a guy to be president?
Well, I'm asking
you. I don't know. It's a dilemma. I think, on the one hand, he's a very interesting man. On the other hand, he's a crashing bar, too. I'll say that if I were in a room with the last seven presidents of the United States, he's the only one I'd want to have a conversation with. Well, I'd probably catch him sweating on his upper lip, which meant he was lying, but I'd like to have the conversation with him.
Why?
Because, you know, here's a guy who comes out of nothing. Nothing. Poor. He does, however, come out with a highly developed intellect and a sense, above all, of what is right and what is wrong. And that is what is interesting to me about Nixon, that he is a man who does know the difference between right and wrong. I'm not sure that a lot of people who have been president really know that. He knew it. He knew it. Unfortunately, he did the wrong thing. For example, when I got into the new tapes, I discovered on two occasions, he has a discussion. You know, one of the mysteries about Watergate is, why didn't Richard Nixon just come out and say, I did it. Mm-hmm. But I did it for you, the American people. I did it to save you from the commies, the rapists, the druggies, the hippies. I'm sorry, but I did it to save you and so forth. He would have been sweating at his upper lip, lying like hell like that. But I assure you, this country, which has a monumental capacity to forgive, would have said, okay. And I think Richard Nixon, he would have been battered, but he would have gone home at the end of his term. I believe that. So why didn't he do it? I've always said that this is really one of the mysteries. Well, the new tapes tell us in a couple of points. He's talking to his aides, and he says, remember, one of the things that he's accused of is having a sponsor of illegal break-in of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. He says, to say that I sponsored an illegal break-in, he's silent. He says, I can't do it. I can't say that the president of the United States did that. Yes, does that on a couple occasions. What he's saying is, for 30 years, he's been a champion of, quote, law and order, mm-hmm. Mr. Goody Two-Shoes, mm-hmm. and now he's going to tell you that he is a crook? It was excruciatingly painful for him to do that. He couldn't do it. I think Bill Clinton could have done it in a wink of an eye. Mm-hmm. I supported Bill Clinton with that when the nonsense of impeachment was being proposed. Mm-hmm. But I have no illusions about Clinton. I used to say I used to go home and shower very heavily. I think Clinton is not a man who knows the difference between right and wrong. It doesn't matter to him. There are other issues to him. But Nixon did. I think that's what's to me, that's what's interesting about him. He's a man of enormous contradictions. And now I've done this play. And this is the way I've tried to approach him. And we'll see when somebody, you may get that rare bird 100 years from now, who will listen to this tape and he'll know what happened, or she'll know what happened. I don't know what's happening yet. I do know this. There's going to be a reading of the play in Washington in December. I've gotten that far.
Stanley, why does Richard Nixon know the difference between right and wrong?
Because he was raised to know those differences. Remember he used to refer to his sainted mother?
Yes.
Oh, you bet. She was a deeply religious woman. She used to say, she used to quote Isaiah, who mocked at people who were always publicly proclaiming their religiosity and praying. Isaiah would say, pray in your closet. This woman would go in her closet and pray. She was deeply committed. His father was 180 degrees the other way. And this clash between mother and father is fascinating. In his childhood, in his later life. But the point is, he learned from both of them. And that's why he is very much a bifurcated personality. I hate to go too much into that. I am not a psychiatrist. I don't want to put somebody on the couch. But I've been living with this material for 15 plus years, and I think I got some sense of him on this. His mother instilled these lessons in him. Now, Clinton liked to talk a lot about his mother. Mm-hmm. His mother used to take him to the racetrack, take him to the saloon, and so forth. And I don't think that he got any great life lessons, at least in terms of morality and right and wrong, out of her. Oh, he may have got some life lessons, but they're not ones that I really care to discuss in terms of the President of the United States.
Stan, did you find on the tapes anything admirable about Richard Nixon?
There were times. But what I found more than anything else was that, Richard Nixon put a political afflatus on everything. He politicized everything. And politics to him meant his political well-being. I think this new book on Kissinger and Nixon is going to show that these men rarely thought about the national interest. The national interest was their interest. And that's why it's very, very difficult to come out with anything positive. Yet at the end of the play, I use his concluding remarks of what is during his White House farewell, where, what a devastating moment. The first president to ever resign. Talk about excruciatingly painful, and yet this man willed his way through it. And one of the ways he willed his way through it was by frankly acknowledging some truths about himself. He was capable of incredible introspection. Incredible introspection. He said at one point, about not hating your opponents and your enemies. He's a man who hated everybody. Yeah, he rarely had a good word to say about anybody. But he said, don't do that because those you hate will hate you back and that'll be your undoing. He believed himself a victim, of course, of these people. But he also said, you talked about, you know, when you're on the May Tri-Rise, you take chances. You reach out, you take chances. And then you reach the top, but you've been taking chances so long, you still dare to take chances. Well, you know, I think a lot of these people become president, develop a certain sense of invulnerability, that they can't be touched. They're like big game jocks who all their lives are pampered, and nothing's ever going to happen to them. You know, Kennedy, here's a guy, he knows J. Edgar Hoover's watching him. And yet here's a guy who's bringing the mistresses of mafioso into the White House for his own pastimes and pleasures. Mm-hmm. He knows he's being watched. Yet I think it was the sense of the dare that excited him. Nixon frankly talked about this.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did Nixon enjoy the dare?
Oh, he enjoyed the dare, absolutely. Well, this is not from that farewell address. There was something he said in another point that it was very, very low. And I think, again, it was, as I said, he was a man capable, time and again, of incredible introspection. He said, you get molded by the laughs, the slights, the snubs you got when you were a kid. If you're angry enough and strong enough, you know he could be angry and strong, you change those attitudes with excellence and gut performances. When you know you must work harder than others, you move out of your alley and you're on the way. You take charge. What's there to lose? It's a piece of cake until you get to the top. But you can't stop. It's part of you, and you need it as much as your arm and leg. So you get lean and mean and resourceful. You like the thrill of playing with danger, with walking on the precipice and not losing your balance. When you get to the top, I guess then you have something to lose. But he implies that this is the way you keep on behaving. Wow. I mean, I think that's incredible. I think that's incredible. And at that farewell address, he says, sometimes we think that when our lives are low, the light is gone forever, but it's not true. He says, greatness comes when things don't always go well for you, but it comes when sadness comes, because only if you've been in the deepest valley can you ever know how magnificent it is to be on the highest mountain. So I think that all this stuff, I think this is great stuff for drama. Well, I mean, I got the idea for a play because I was going through the tapes. I was trying to put together this book. I was wide awake at 4 o'clock in the morning because I was under the deadline. I thought to myself, God, this is stuff of drama. Well, the rest, okay.
So, Stanley, you posed the question, how did this man ever become elected president?
Oh, I don't know. That's our problem. I don't know.
So that's, I give that question back
yeah,
to you.
Well, the point is that becoming president now is really survival of the least common denominator, I suppose. We want to see ourselves in a president, and a lot of people saw themselves in Richard Nixon, I guess.
Really?
I think so. I think so. You know, somebody wrote a book, one time critic of Nixon who now admires him, and he wrote a book called One of Us. He said, who among us hasn't broken the law? Who among us has not skirted the Constitution? Richard Nixon was just one of us. To which I said in reply, no, Richard Nixon was president of the United States. He's supposed to be better than us. But he wasn't. I don't know. This will take me off into questions of the nature of the political system, the way the whole system works now, so forth. Many things of which I have profound misgivings, and which I don't find this being the time or place to discuss it. So,
anyhow. Stan, did you meet Haldeman or Ehrlichman? I know you know Dean.
Dean I know very well. I met Haldeman and Ehrlichman very fleetingly at a conference, and they made it clear they didn't want anything to do with me. When I asked Haldeman, I wrote him and asked him formally for an interview. And he said, well, I can't do that. He said, I'm glad that you're doing a serious study of Watergate, because when you get finished, maybe you'll be able to tell us the truth of who did it and what happened. I thought to myself, what's he saying? Oh, he was a great dissembler. I mean, I've caught incredible lies out of his diary, etc. But
is he still alive?
No.
They're both dead.
Oh, yeah. It's a diminishing crew. After all, these were men who were acting in government 37 years ago. So, Watergate is almost history.
Any other key players beyond those three that you're interested in that you talked
about? Well, I mentioned Nixon's lawyer, mm-hmm. Leonard Garment, who was very, very important to me, very useful to me. And the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, was very interesting. He acknowledged to me that the CIA had helped cover up, but he said we quickly backed off, which is true. And 14 years after that interview, somebody's doing a big book on the CIA now. They knew I had that interview. They asked me for it. I knew why they wanted it. Helms made a remark to me about laundering money, which it was incredible what he said to me. And I tried to interest several people in the story. Time magazine for 3 months was pushing, this reporter was pushing the story. And finally, I don't know whether it was pressure from above, but he couldn't get it published. What Helms admitted to me was that the CIA never had to launder money because they had their own worldwide arbitrage arrangement, meaning that the CIA can raise money anywhere, anytime in the world. You know, they don't need appropriations of Congress. They can do whatever they want. And, he just got his book. Somebody I know is going to make use of that now.
Very interesting.
So, the remark was made to me 14 years ago, and I was a little, I quoted it in my book, but I wasn't going to discuss arbitrage at the rate, like, what little I understand of it. So,
what is your opinion of John Dean?
Oh, well, I think John Dean is a great person. Oh, absolutely. John Dean, in my book, at which time I had met him only once, you know, I made it clear that I thought, you know, he did a good thing and the right thing, but in describing him, I referred to him. It wasn't my idea. It was Sam Dash, who was the chief investigator of the Senate committee, called him the Gentile Sammy Glick. Now, a lot of people won't know what that means today, but there's a very famous novel from the 1930s or 40s called What Makes Sammy Run.
Yes.
Sammy Glick was a Hollywood producer, a fictional, who, well, to put it mildly, would have sliced his mother's throat to get ahead. And so I referred to John as a Gentile Sammy Glick. John later said to me, Stanley, why did you say that? And I said, well, John, maybe I shouldn't have said it. I said, but you know, you're the one who titled your own book Blind Ambition. Mm-hmm. You were an ambitious human, and he was. But he has, well, he's now written prominent books. He's an incredible critic. He's a brilliant man, and he's a good friend, and his wife is a dear friend. And I treasure the friendship.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I just saw him a couple of, about 2 months ago in L.A., and he was here. We did a program here together.
Yes, I saw that.
Yes, it was a kind of happening. All of Madison's old progressive crowd came out to, I don't know, fondle the moment or something. It was incredible. And so John and I did this program together, and John came here to Madison, and he was kind of struck by our city, and he noticed the bus. He's a great walker. He goes around. He noticed our bus signs that said, it's time to move your dial to the left and listen to Al Franken. And John thought that was kind of uproarious. So he's become a good friend. And there'd been a number of nice friends out of this. Let's not make me list them because we don't want to hold them accountable.
But Stanley, I've always been curious about Pat Nixon. Did she have, who was she? Did she
Well, that's
have
an interesting question. She's a character in my play. My play is a one-man play. Uh-huh. It's really only Nixon, except that there are some voices on the side. Ma, Pa, his football coach. His football coach was Vince Lombardi before there was a Vince Lombardi. Uh-huh. And Pat. Now, I use Pat as a foil. We know that in later years she was bitter, disgusted with how her life had turned out and so forth. But she always remained loyal. But I have her, like for example, one of the opening lines of the play is Nixon's talking about meeting this great Irish girl, Thelma, Pat Ryan, born on St. Patrick's Day. And she says very quietly, the day before, Dick. You know, he's always gilding the lily with things like that. So I have her do that. And then sometimes she's my voice, but in calling Nixon to account on things and so forth. But she's not without interest. I mean, there's not much in the way we can document a lot of this. You know, the first time Nixon ever dances in public is at his daughter's wedding, because he's a Quaker. When he wanted to be a Quaker, he could be a Quaker. Yeah. For him to... One of the great experiences I had with the tape, I had some stenographers helping me with it, to give me a rough first draft, then I'd have to go back and listen to it. They send me this material. It's after Nixon fires Haldeman and Ehrlichman. He goes on national television. And then he gets these phone calls. The first one's from Haldeman. And he says to Haldeman, he says, I love you, Bob. I love you like a brother. Nixon say, I love you? A man could never tell his wife, I love you. Mm-hmm. His daughters. That's odd. So when I go listen to the tape, I hear the tape. He was sloshed. He was drunk. That's one of the clearest examples of his drinking that I heard on the tapes. He says to Haldeman, I love you, Bob. I love you like a brother. And, you know, it's really eerie. But he was a man really incapable of that kind of expression to his wife, to his children, to parents. Now, he was raised that way in many ways. His mother, I told you, was a stern Quaker moralist. His father was, I think he was a son of a bitch. He was known to have the loudest voice in all of Orange County. And he was a thumper, as Richard Nixon said. In other words, he used to cuff Nixon quite a bit. So, I don't know, you know, there have been a couple of attempts to analyze Nixon by shrinks and so forth. We know that Richard Nixon regularly visited a psychiatrist during the Eisenhower years and afterward. And this guy later talked a little bit, but I don't believe he talked very much. But there's that material is around somewhere. And then I suppose someday somebody will get at it. I don't know. But, you know, it's a rather self-important psychiatrist, and I don't know, I'd be a little leery of some of his evaluation. Mm-hmm. I just believe in letting Nixon talk. So.
What else do the Nixon tapes reveal, Stanley?
Well, a lot. I mean, they reveal... I mean, let's talk about Nixon personally. I alluded to this before. One of the striking things to me is this man never has a good word to say about anybody. One of the few people who escapes his wrath and criticism is John Connally, who had been governor of Texas, a Democrat, but becomes a Republican. Nixon would like to have named him vice president, but the Republicans and Democrats alike wouldn't have slipped Zilfoys. But Connally, he thought, was God. He thought he was just such a great man. I don't know how and why he thought this, but that's such an exception. I mean, he would talk about everybody. I mean, he talked about his wife. Now, we don't have that on tape because that's all been struck, but we know it because it's in Haldeman's Daily Notes. I mean...
Critically,
like yes, yeah, things that she wanted to do, so forth. But he's just, I mean, and of course he's consumed by the Kennedys, you know. The fact, a decisive moment in Richard Nixon's life is losing the election in 1960, and the way he did. I mean, you know, he believed they stole the election from him. They didn't. But it traumatized him. I mean, he just was paranoid about the Kennedys. He had Teddy Kennedy followed.
Really?
Yeah, to catch Teddy with his girls and so forth. But you know, I mean, there were times Nixon was so inept. For an articulate man, he could be horribly inarticulate. You know, there are these great interviews that were done after he left the presidency with David Frost.
Mm-hmm.
They're good. Anyhow, Frost comes to the Nixon house to start the interviews, and Nixon greets him and says, "Well, did you fornicate this weekend?" And he's taken aback by this. Nixon was inept. He didn't know what to say to people. He just, I call him socially autistic. Huh. That's strange. But, well, listen, we'll keep running. I mean, nobody's left material like he has, you know. I mean, now, one thing that no one's going to find. No one's going to find that things that Nixon did, that we have said Nixon did, were not done. We've got him admitting on the new tapes that, yes, he paid cover-up money to the burglars and so forth. I mean, you nail him every which way, mm-hmm. Okay? No, some people are going to come along and find a greater humanity than other people. Others are going to find him more sympathetic than I find him empathetic. Such is the nature of the historical enterprise. But if anybody wants to come along and say, oh, Nixon was railroaded and was an honest man and so forth, they're going to have to fly in the face of some solid evidence, mm-hmm. to the contrary. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I did what I did, because I have no doubt. I have no doubt. If I hadn't done it, I mean, I've been told this by others, and I know it myself. If I hadn't done it, there'd be no tapes. They would have been burned long ago.
Oh, really? You think they would have destroyed them?
Absolutely. 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 Well.
Huh. I'm very grateful that
You filed the lawsuit.
Well, I have to.
At this point, Stanley, could any American go to the Nixon library
Absolutely.
And listen to any of the tapes?
All those that have been processed, all but the last $800. Yep. It's all available.
And are the originals stored in the Nixon library?
The originals are, they're back in the Nixon family's possession. They won that. That was not involved my suit. But they got that, and all the material that the archives had to excise out, like involving his wife or his children, he had to get that original material. He would, his estate. So where it is now, I can't tell you. So.
This concludes side one of tape four. This is side two of tape four, Stanley Cutler.
By way of conclusion, I just should mention that throughout all of this, I've had an incredible network of helpful, stimulating friends, but above all, I've had an incredible support system of my wife and my children, and my grandchildren. Had I known they were this good, I would have skipped the children. Right to the heart of the matter. Okay.
This concludes the oral history interview with the quite accomplished and quite extraordinary Stanley Cutler. Thank you, Stanley.
Thank you, Bob.